Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com.
And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
I'm Kate Young. Welcome to Earth Eats.
I've had many a breakdown in the middle of the grocery store because I can't afford healthy food. You just do what you have to do each day.
This week on our show, we continue our discussion of SNAP, also known as food stamps. Harvest Public Media has a story on some of the barriers and requirements to receiving food assistance. And we return to our conversation with Angela Babb from Indiana University's Department of Geography. She examines some of the contradictions between the USDA recommended diets and what's actually affordable at the grocery store. Spring rains and warmer temperatures mean it's time for foraging in the woods for wild edibles. We have two recipes for ramps from Chef Daniel Orr. That's all coming up, so stay tuned to Earth Eats. First, let's go to Alex Chambers for a roundup of this week's news.
That's right, Kate. We've got stories this week on livestock and on glyphosate. A California appeals court this week ruled that the state has a right to label glyphosate, the main ingredient in popular weed killer Roundup, as a possible carcinogen. Sound familiar? That's because a different California court made the same ruling last year, citing a 1986 measure that requires states to publish a list of chemicals known to cause cancer. Monsanto challenged last year's ruling in both state and federal court, claiming that the state was illegally delegating lawmaking powers to the International Agency for Research on Cancer, an arm of the World Health Organization that Monsanto called an unaccountable foreign agency in their suit. The Fifth District Court of Appeal in Fresno preserved California's authority to list glyphosate as a possible carcinogen and prohibit discharge of the chemical into waterways. At the heart of the debate are two scientific studies, one by the EPA that declares the chemical has low toxicity to humans, the other by the World Health Organization, which found that the chemical could cause cancer in humans. This week's decision was hailed by environmentalists and food safety advocates. Rebecca Riley, a lawyer for the Natural Resources Defense Council in San Francisco, said it was a win for science and democracy. The ruling, she said, clearly backs the voters' choice to rely on expert scientific bodies to add dangerous chemicals to its list. In the coming weeks, Monsanto could ask the state Supreme Court to review this week's ruling. And a new study says a devastating livestock disease could come to the United States through two things animals need: food and vitamins. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has more.
Soybean meal, vitamins, and other ingredients are often imported from around the globe, including China. The study released in March put 11 viruses into samples of different ingredients. Then the samples went through simulated temperature and humidity conditions for a trip across land and sea. Scott D. of Pipestone Veterinary Services and colleagues at Kansas State and other universities found 7 viruses lived.
There's a growing body of evidence that it's pretty hard to refute the fact that this could be a significant risk factor for pathogen transport between countries.
Iowa State University veterinarian Jim Roth wasn't involved in the study, but he looks at foreign disease threats and says the most feared virus, foot and mouth disease, is present in China but has not yet arrived here. So the threat is real, he says, but may not be imminent. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Thanks to Harvest Public Media and Taylor Killow for those reports.
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is the country's biggest federal food aid effort and is a large part of the Farm Bill that Congress is looking to renew this year. In the first of a five-part series, Harvest Public Media's Erica Hunsinger provides a primer on who qualifies, how they apply, and the challenges they face.
Just in January, the government spent almost $5 billion on SNAP, supporting more than 40 million people. But the allotments often don't get recipients through even an entire month.
Sometimes maybe an electric bill doesn't get paid. You just kind of scramble. I will tell you that our diet really suffers.
That's Jennifer, who lives in Excelsior Springs, Missouri, about 30 miles northeast of Kansas City. Her three-person household receives about $250 a month.
I've had many a breakdown in the middle of the grocery store because I can't afford healthy food. You just do what you have to do each day.
Hi, my name is Cheryl, and I'm 58 years old.
Cheryl is a lifelong Kansas City resident. She's homeless and gets the maximum amount per month allowed for one person, $192.
But I feed more than just me off of that.
She says it covers about 2 or 2.5 weeks' worth of food. That's in part because she helps take care of her 75-year-old mother.
When you have a family house, people come over, the family, and if they're hungry, they're going to go in the icebox and get something. So there goes some of your food there, you know, the grandkids.
Cheryl also supplements her benefits by visiting a food pantry. Dustin Hardison says that's common for SNAP recipients. He runs food pantry operations for Catholic Charities of Northeast Kansas.
That was actually a call we got last week.
When I first started 4 years ago, I would tell people that SNAP would last people 3 weeks. And the amount of food we were giving would last somebody a week. But I'm almost thinking it's gone to 2 weeks and 2 weeks.
So, anyway.
Several places help identify people who could be on SNAP, like food banks, pantries, and emergency assistance offices. But this entitlement program is not a passive handout. You have to qualify, and there are strict limits. First, they look at how much you make. For a household of four, it's not more than about $32,000 a year. Plus, there are work requirements for able-bodied adults. Cheryl was convicted of a felony drug possession a while back and was banned from qualifying for SNAP. But a couple years ago, her brother told her the law had changed in Missouri.
You could murder someone and you could get him. You could rob someone and you could get him. Well, I was kind of annoyed with that system, that law. And so when my brother mentioned it, I went for it.
The process starts with an application, which can be filled out on paper or online. The length of paper applications vary from state to state. Kansas's is 17 pages, while Iowa's and Missouri's are only 6. The applications ask you for things that would send any person digging through their files. Social security numbers, bank account balances, value of stocks, bonds, and retirement accounts, value of vehicles, monthly expenses, whether you've been convicted of trading food benefits. Remember Jennifer, who says bills sometimes go unpaid? She's actually a caseworker, too. So she's familiar with the challenges that come along with signing up for SNAP.
You're jumping hoops all the time, and then you'll turn in yourself and say, oh, we didn't get it.
Once that's out of the way, there's an interview process. That's where Cheryl got held up. For a year, she says, she called every number there was and was also told she'd get a phone call.
But then I got discouraged, you know, because it shouldn't have took a whole year to connect with them people. Because I waited on the interview phone call, it never came.
SNAP recipients live everywhere, cities, small towns, rural areas, and the advantage of living in a city is that offices and potential jobs are more easily reachable by public transportation. That's an issue, considering Missouri has one of the highest rates of rural and small-town SNAP recipients in the Midwest. Jennifer's organization covers rural areas in 2 counties.
So we have a lot of people who can't access food stamps because of that part.
In the end, Cheryl and Jennifer say the hurdles are worth it.
When I was growing up, we didn't have food stamps. My family struggled, and I went to bed hungry often.
She says she feels good knowing her kids aren't going through the same thing.
That's been the biggest blessing. It's just that one little bit of, I don't have to worry today.
Erica Hunsinger, Harvest Public Media.
Stay tuned in the coming weeks as Harvest Public Media looks at the SNAP program through the lens of the work requirements, immigration, mental health, and the military. Visit their website at harvestpublicmedia.org. It's ramp season here in southern Indiana. If you're not familiar, ramps are a type of wild leek. They've got a small white bulb and wide leafy green tops that are tender and tasty. If you're lucky and you know a spot, you can forage your own out in the woods. You can also usually pick some up at the local farmer's market this time of year. Chef Daniel Orr has been cooking with ramps for many years now. He even offers a special ramp menu in the early spring to celebrate these culinary superstars. Earth Eats founder and former host Annie Corrigan talked with Chef Daniel Orr and Chef Bob Atkins a few years ago about a couple of ramp recipes at Farm Bloomington Restaurant.
The thing about ramps is it's a very fleeting season. You can find the flowering heads after they've kind of, you know, passed the edible stage, and you want to let those be, but burn that into your mind so next year in the spring you can go back and find them. We're going to do a pickled ramp, and then we're also going to do a ramp pesto. So what we've done is we've cut off these green tops and I've put them in a nice pickling jar, and we're going to make a brine to pour over them, and then we can keep them in the refrigerator for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, a year, and you can utilize that vinegar for the flavor into vinaigrettes and sauces and things, and then you can also pull out the ramps and eat them like pickles, let's say with a cheese platter or with smoked meats, things like that. You can use them in lots of different things. You can also chop them up and put them in a sauce or sprinkle them on top of a roasted fish. So there's lots of ways you can use them.
You cut the leaves off. Why are we not pickling the leaves?
Well, the leaves would turn a kind of a dark, ugly color. So that's why we separate the bulbs and the greens, and we're going to make the pesto with the greens. So that's the next recipe. We've got everything for that right here. And you can see I've got the leaves here, which I've just blanched, and they are kind of garlicky, but I like to add a couple cloves of regular garlic, a couple flecks of pressed red pepper. See here, and you can smell that. It's got a nice oniony, garlicky aroma to it. If you're going to freeze it, I'd freeze it just like that. But if you're going to use it right away, you can add cheese.
Now, you have the hot sauce here. Not to tell you how to use your mojo, but I would love some hot sauce.
Yeah, well, I like to add a couple drops in. Again, it's to taste. This does have some habaneros in it, so I'm just going to add probably about a teaspoon.
Chef Bob Atkins has become our resident ramps expert, so I tracked him down to taste the finished product.
Oh, no expert.
You picked these.
I did pick these.
And so now we turned it into a pesto. What do you think?
It's fabulous. It's got a nice bite. It's rich. A lot of different flavors and textures.
So, that was a really quick run through on those two recipes. But don't worry, all the details can be found, as always, on our website. EarthEats.org is the place to look. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. We're back, Alex.
Yes, we are, Kate.
So last week we had Angela Babb on our show.
Yeah, she was talking about the history of the Farm Bill and food stamps, which is also known as SNAP.
And can you remind us who Angela Babb is?
She's a food researcher from Indiana University's Department of Geography.
Right. And in particular, she studies the Thrifty Food Plan.
What's the Thrifty Food Plan?
Well, from what I understand, it's basically food budgeting. The USDA looks at the amount of money that a household would need to buy food, and that's how they allocate how much money goes to each SNAP recipient. She touches on it later in the interview.
Oh, okay. Last week, she talked about the earliest farm bill and how food assistance got connected to it in the first place. It had to do with helping farmers move their surplus crops.
Right. So the USDA runs SNAP.
Along with other government nutrition programs.
Okay, but what is the USDA, the Department of Agriculture? What do they do?
Let's let Angela Babb explain.
The USDA is the largest, most diverse department out of the U.S. government. They are overseeing marketing support for farmers. They're overseeing rural development and nutrition assistance and forestry. The clearest conflict of interest is between the marketing of agricultural goods and the development of nutritional guidelines and nutritional assistance programs. Historically, those agricultural goods that we're producing are corn and soy and wheat. At the same time, the nutritional guidelines are directing people to eat the specialty crops, the fruits and vegetables and legumes that aren't supported financially by the farm bill. So it's pretty ironic telling folks in poverty to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables when those are more expensive than the cheap grains that have been processed into millions of different products at this point.
Right, which are in the boxes in the middle of the supermarket and are more affordable and, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the suggestion is to get the food stamp program or the nutrition assistance programs and the dietary guidelines out of the USDA and hand them over to the Department of Health and Human Services. Yeah, so that's the call, but the USDA has been reluctant to get rid of their part in the nutritional assistance programs because those have always been an outlet for the surplus commodities that they're supporting through the farm bill.
The lobbies or the parts of the USDA that have an interest in supporting corn, soy, wheat, these large-scale commodity crops that are being subsidized, want to hold on to SNAP because it's a way to move those commodities within the U.S. Is that right?
Yeah, SNAP and TFAP.
So, and what is TFAP?
So the Emergency Food Assistance Program is the direct line to the food banks and the commodity boxes that are then distributed to senior citizens and to Native American reservations. And under Trump's new proposal, to just about every household on SNAP. So that's, it seems less clear now that the food stamp program has changed so that people presumably have a choice on how to use their food stamps. But economically, when they get to the store, that choice is really limited because of the relative price of foods at the store. It's still those cheap processed corn and soy products that are the most affordable and most accessible to folks on SNAP.
What do you think would be a good next step in terms of reorganizing all of this? How would you fix the world, Angela Babb?
Well, that's a loaded question. I'll do my best. I mean, to be totally real with you, I would say we have to get out of the frame of food security and think about food sovereignty and the ability of farmers to have a real choice in what they're growing, to have foods valued not in their market price, but in, you know, their nutritional and their cultural values. And to have folks struggling in poverty, to have a more dynamic safety net program. I personally study the Thrifty Food Plan, which is this model diet that underlies the SNAP allotment. So it determines how much people get in food stamps. And the calculation needs to be changed. It's not enough money for people to afford a really nutritious, culturally appropriate diet. So we need the safety net there. We need to, you know, have SNAP or something similar in place, but the program itself needs to change quite a bit. And I would be a proponent too of shifting the regulation of it over to the Health and Human Services Department. I think it's really important to recognize that there's plenty of food. The issue is not the availability of food. We currently produce more than twice what we need in this country. But what we're producing is not ecologically sustainable. It's not culturally appropriate for most Americans. And the way that we've prioritized cheap food and convenient food and driven down the value of food has terrible implications for folks in poverty expected to survive on that cheap processed food, to survive on the surplus or basically the waste of large agribusiness.
Can you say a little bit more about the cultural appropriateness or lack thereof?
Yeah, so one thing I find really alarming is in the Thrifty Food Plan that determines the budget that these, you know, SNAP households have to live on, there is an assumption that households are consuming over 3 cups of liquid milk every day. The reason for that is because of the way we've subsidized corn. We've effectively subsidized dairy, and now milk has become the cheapest form of protein, and it's been fortified with some vitamins. So there are roughly 1 in 4 Americans that are lactose intolerant. Globally, 60% of the population is lactose intolerant. It is not typical for folks to be able to digest lactose after the age of 2. But the dairy lobby has been very effective in maintaining those subsidies and maintaining their interests within the Farm Bill. And we expect folks, even the educational part of SNAP, the SNAP program trains folks that are lactose intolerant to consume more and more milk to try to build a tolerance rather than respect the fact that people are lactose intolerant. They don't need or want to be drinking that surplus dairy. It's and frankly, it's racist, too, when you think of when you realize how people of color are disproportionately more likely to be lactose intolerant. Something like close to 100% of Native Americans, 90% of African Americans, 80-some percent of Asian Americans. Like, I think 60% of Hispanic Americans. So it's really not culturally appropriate to be expecting these folks to, one, live on that much dairy when their bodies don't need it or want it, but also to survive on those processed foods high in sugar and salt that are leading to issues of, you know, diabetes and cardiovascular disease and hypertension, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. That's really fascinating to hear about the dairy and the ways that, like, the actual diet itself that gets laid out is itself has racial implications.
Mm-hmm.
Is itself racist, I should say.
It really is. I mean, it's institutionalized racism,
mm-hmm.
yet another form of it.
Wow. This is totally new to me.
What's new to you?
I didn't realize that people of color were more likely to be lactose intolerant. I didn't even know that lactose intolerance was so common.
Yeah, and I didn't realize milk was part of the whole surplus commodity issue.
Yeah, usually we think corn, soybeans, maybe wheat. But it does make sense.
Right, because subsidizing corn means subsidizing the feed for all the cows.
Yep.
So what's new to me is the thrifty food plan. I want to hear more about that. I want to know how it's determined, what's in it.
I think we need to get Angela Babb back in the studio.
That is her focus. So yeah, she's definitely the person to talk to.
Okay, we'll do that. In the meantime, find links to more on these topics at eartheats.org. That's it for our show this week. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. We love to hear from you, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't. You can send us a message, eartheats@gmail.com, or leave a review on iTunes. You'll find us on Twitter, too, @EarthEats. Support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services. Assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Shout out to the Earth Eats crew, including Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Angela Babb. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey.